I want to get you tonight, if you would, to turn with me the book of Ecclesiastes. Ecclesiastes. You know, at the beginning of this book, we're confronted with a question. It's not stated specifically, but as you read through it, you begin to see what the question is. The question is this: is life worth living? And what the writer, who calls himself the preacher, but then in the first verse, as you notice, he reveals to you who he is. He is the son of David. He is king in Jerusalem. He's Solomon. At least that's who I believe him to be. And earlier in this series of studies, as we've been looking at different individuals in the Old Testament, we looked at Solomon, we looked at his rise and his fall. Tonight I want to take you down a different road with Solomon. I want to share with you his own search for meaning in life and his examination, because what Solomon does is he conducts an experiment of sorts in which he investigates and looks into what he calls life under the sun. When he finishes his study, his initial conclusion is, no, life is really not worth living. All is vanity and striving after the wind, or vanity of vanities, all is vanity, depending on which way he's saying it at the time. And he supports that with four basic arguments. He says that life is not worth living because life is monotonous. Life is not worth living because wisdom is vain, because wealth is futile, and all of us are going to die. Death is certain. Until he adds something else into the equation. He backs up and reexamines it from the perspective of what happens when we put God into life. And he comes to a different conclusion. He realizes then that life is worth living. It makes a difference. Suddenly, the monotonous life becomes a life that is filled with challenging situations that God has brought in our lives, each in its own time, each with its own purpose. Not only that, while wisdom cannot explain everything, man's wisdom that is, it is better to follow God's wisdom than to follow after folly. And as for wealth, it can be enjoyed if it is used to the glory of God. As for the inescapability of death, that should motivate us. It should motivate us to enjoy life now and to make the most of the opportunities that God gives to us while we are living. And so as we come to the end of this little book, it's only 12 chapters long, I want to draw your minds to four pictures that Solomon paints. They're found in chapters 11 and 12. And with these pictures that he paints, he gives us, after each one, a little advice, if you will, to follow. And it's that advice that I want to share with you as we look at the pictures that he paints. So as we move over to chapter 11, the first thing that he shares with us is this: life is an adventure, but we must live it by faith. And he gives us two illustrations there in verses 1 through 6. The first is an illustration of a merchant with ships. The other is a farmer sowing seed. And in both of these activities, what Solomon realizes and what I think all of us realize is that they require a great deal of faith. And here's why I say that: because neither the merchant nor the farmer can control the circumstances of life. The merchant sends out his ships, but there's a possibility that those ships may run upon a reef. Those ships may encounter a terrible storm. Those ships may be attacked by a pilot, and he may lose his entire investment. The farmer's crop could be easily destroyed by bad weather, by blight, or by insects, thus making all of his labor in vain. But here's the thing: if either the merchant or the farmer decide that they're going to wait until all of the circumstances are ideal, then the merchant would never send out his ships, the farmer would never plant his seed. Now you see, life requires a certain amount of risk, does it not? We all take a certain amount of risk. We may not realize that. You took a certain amount of risk when you pulled out of your garage or out of your driveway to come to this period of worship this evening. But yet you thought it was an acceptable risk to be here tonight. And I'm glad you chose that. You see, faith has to play a part in any risk that we take when it comes to living our lives. So let's look more closely at what he says to us about the merchant. Cast your bread upon many waters. You could paraphrase that to say, send your ships or your grain out in ships. Solomon's ships were constantly, we go back to 1 Kings chapter 10, and we see that his ships were constantly going out and bringing back various goods. And some of his ships, especially when you look at chapter 10 of 1 Kings, there in verse 12, some of his ships could take as long as 3 years to return with what they were coming back with. And yet when they did return, for the merchant that is, his faith and his patience were rewarded. He waited. He determined it was worth the risk, but he had to wait for it. And verse 2 tells us that we need to spread out our wealth, as he points out here, in more than just one basket, we might say. 7 or 8 he's bringing out. In other words, don't put it all in one place. Spread it out. Lessen your risk. When it comes to the farmer, he tells us there that, well, let me back up and say, first of all, that farming, and most of those who have ever farmed know that it's not an easy way to make a living. Farming takes a lot of work. And even with that, in today's market, there are some farmers that struggle just to get by. But the people of Israel, in Solomon's day, they were constantly working with rocky soil. Not only that, they depended upon the early and the latter rains if they were ever going to have any hope for a crop. So the farmer is at the mercy of nature, and he must not sit around and wait for the ideal circumstances. And so, as we find Solomon saying here, the wind's never right, in essence, for the sower. The clouds never right for the reaper. And if the sower waits for the wind just to be right, he'll never plant the seed. If he waits for the rain to be right, if he worries about the rain, he'll never harvest his crops. How many of a farmer has watched that weather to determine whether or not he needs to cut his hay? Because he doesn't want that hay to get wet. And sometimes the weatherman's right and sometimes the weatherman's wrong. More often they're wrong than they're right. Somebody said they're the only people that can be wrong more than 50% of the time and still keep their job. But the farmers take a chance. They cut the hay because they know they've got to get their crop in. They harvest their crop. And as he points out in verse 5, we don't know the way of the wind. Neither do we know the way that an infant is formed in its mother's womb. So no one knows the activity of God in his creation. We must use each day wisely. And we must get up early, sow our seed, work hard until evening, but then trust God for the harvest, because God is the one that gives the blessing. So life is an adventure. Live it out in faith. Work hard. Trust God. Let Him bring forth the harvest. We do that when we sow the seed of the gospel. Is that not right? What did Paul say? I planted, Apollos watered, but God gave the increase. Folks, the truth is, I stand here before you as nothing more than a seed sower and a seed waterer. I may prepare the soil once in a while, but God is the one that brings forth the harvest. Every single one of us do the same thing. We sow seed. We water it. We encourage. But ultimately, it's God that brings forth the harvest. So we live by faith and we trust in Him and we pray that He will bring forth a great harvest. The second thing that Solomon brings out is what we find there in chapter 11, specifically in verses 7 and going on through chapter 12, verse 8. Because there he tells us about light being pleasant, it's good for the eyes to see the sun. Indeed, if a man should live many years, let him rejoice in them all, and let him remember the days of darkness, for they will be many. Everything that is to come will be futility. And then he says to the youth, rejoice, young man, in the days of your during your childhood, and let your heart be pleasant during the days of your young manhood, and follow the impulses or the desires of your heart, as the King James says, and the sight of your eyes or the desires of your eyes, yet know that God will bring you into judgment for all these things. There are three things he tells us. Number one, he says, rejoice. We must anticipate each new day, and we must accept that new day as a gift from God. There was a preacher one time that would pray every night, Lord, thank you for giving me another day to serve you. And I pray I've used that day to serve you wisely. Every morning he would get up, and as he woke up, he would say, Lord, thank you for granting me another day to serve you this morning. Let me use it wisely on your behalf. Solomon instructs us to take advantage of the days of our youth. He says, before the days of darkness come. What's he referring about? First of all, he's telling us that youth is the time of enjoyment. It's in our youth before the problems of old age start to reveal themselves. I've heard more than one of you say, growing old is not fun. You've told me about different health issues, and if I knew that growing old was going to be like this, I don't know that I would have looked forward to it. What Solomon says is that the youth, our young people, need to guard their hearts. And they need to watch their eyes. Because either one or both of them can lead them into sin. When he says follow the impulses of your heart or walk in the ways of your heart, he's not saying that our young need to pursue that youthful fling, that they need to sow their wild oats and satisfy the sinful desires that they may have within. That's not what he's saying at all. What he is saying is that they need to enjoy. Our young people need to enjoy being young, because that is the time that God gives them to be able to appreciate youth. And there are things that can be experienced and enjoyed in youth that can never be enjoyed as we get older, not in the way that we enjoyed it as a young person. And I know that there are many of you that probably can look back over your youth and think about the things that you did as a young person, and you think about, I wouldn't dare try that now for nothing in the world, because I'd break something, I'd hurt something, and I might not recover from it. But God gives us that youth to enjoy that with. But he says something else in this. He says, not only are we to rejoice, we are to remove something. And that is found in verse 10. Remove grief and anger from your heart and put away pain from your body, because childhood and the prime of life are fleeting. You know, we must teach our young people to put anxiety out of their hearts. I really hate when I see a young person that just seems to have so much anxiety in their life, so much that they're worrying about, and I think this is the time that you ought to be enjoying your life. You ought to be having a fun time. They need to also remove evil from the flesh. Put it aside. Choose not to walk in that direction, because young people who take care of their minds and their bodies and avoid the destructive sins of the flesh and build good habits of health and holiness, as they grow older, they have so much to look forward to. They don't have regrets that they have to live with for the rest of their life. I wish I'd never done that. I wish I'd never chosen to go down that path. I wish I'd never, whatever it may have been. No, because the years of our youth pass away so quickly, we must not waste those opportunities to prepare for the future. Because if we prepare wisely as a young person for the future, then our future can be bright and God can bless us in ways that we may not have even thought about. So what does he tell us to do? Remember. That's the third thing. In chapter 12, beginning in verse 1 and going through verse 8, basically what he's saying there, remember also your Creator in the days of your youth, before the evil days come and the years draw near when you will say, I have no delight in them. And he says the time to begin thinking about God, to focus upon God, to pay attention to God is when you're young. You see, it's easy for a young person to get so caught up in the enjoyments of life and in the opportunities of youth that they neglect the Lord. I was listening to something just this past week that said that the prime opportunity to reach young people for Christ is when they're young. Well, I just told you that. The best time to reach a person for Christ is when they're young. When they're in their youth. Why? Because the evil days are coming. The days, according to Solomon, when you will say, I have no pleasure in them. So because the evil days are coming, it's important to lay a good spiritual foundation when you're young. I am thankful that when I was young, there were people that took an interest in me and pulled me into different things. There were members of the church that were opening their homes to the young people and saying, come over here, we're going to play volleyball, and then we're going to grill out. Come over here, we're going to do this, or we're going to do that. And every Sunday night, there was somewhere to go, especially in the summer. And then there were things to do throughout the school year that kept us involved in activities that strengthened us in our faith, or at least moved us in that direction if we were not Christians. And I loved being around my friends who were Christians, to spend time with them and have fun doing good things. I have a youth that I look back on with great pride because of the people that were a part of my life in those days. But then Solomon says something, and for those of you that are older, it can be quite depressing. As you look in verse 3 and you go through verse 7, he talks about the evil days. Some of those things are what happens to us as we age. And he gives a vivid description of what begins to happen as we age. And then eventually death. Notice what he says. He says, in the day that the watchmen of the house tremble and the mighty men stoop, the grinding ones stand while idle because they're few, and those who look through windows grow dim, and the doors on the street are shut as the sound of the grinding mill is low, and one will arise at the sound of the bird, and all the daughters of song or music will sing softly. Furthermore, men are afraid of a high place and of terrors on the road. The almond tree blossoms, the grasshopper drags itself along or himself along, and the caperberry is ineffective, for man goes to his eternal home while mourners go about in the street. He's describing what happens to us as we age. Let me share with you the way it's been interpreted. Some of these can go one way or the other. But when he speaks of the watchmen or the keepers of the house, he tells us there will come a time when your arms and your legs begin to tremble. They're not as stout as they used to be as you grow older. He speaks of the mighty men or the strong. It's your legs, your knees, your shoulders. They become weaker. At some point you walk, and you walk with a stoop because you don't walk as upright as you did as a young man or a young woman. He speaks of the grinding ones or the grinders. You start losing your teeth. The windows that are closed or shut. The windows, rather, he says here, are dim. You don't see as well as you used to. Your vision begins to deteriorate. He speaks of the doors on the street are shut to the sound of grinding. It's either that your hearing starts to fail or that you close your mouth because you're losing your teeth. You don't smile quite as much as you used to because there aren't as many teeth left there to give a smile with. You rise up, you are arise. How many of you, at least a little sound wakes you up now, where used to you slept through the night? You wake up the birds early every morning because that noise just suddenly you're awake and you can't go back to sleep. You wish you could sleep longer, but the noises woke you up. the music or the song, the daughters of song or the daughters of music, your voice starts to quaver and weaken. You can't sing those high notes, ladies, that you used to sing. Men, your voices aren't as strong as they used to be when you were young and you'd sing out. Why? It's because you're getting older. The almond tree blossoms. If you have any hair left, it turns white like the almond blossoms. The grasshopper, as he says here, drags himself along. Suddenly we reach a point where we kind of drag ourselves along like a grasshopper at the close of the summer season. Your desire, you lose appetite. Your external or long home that he speaks about is in verse 6. It's that eternal home and people mourn your death. And then in these last two verses, if you'll notice here, he speaks about the golden bowl and the silver cord. It's a silver cord that was used in that day, and a bowl would be, a lamp would be inside of it, and it would be suspended from the ceiling. But when the cord broke, the bowl fell, and bowl fell, it broke. What he's talking about is the end of your life. The cord breaks, the bowl falls, the light goes out. Or he speaks about the wheel at the cistern, and it breaks, and the pitcher at the well shatters. You see, life comes to an end. As I said, it's not for the weak of heart, because he's telling us this is what happens. This is why it's so important that we honor Christ when we're young, that we rejoice in our youth, and that we walk in the ways of our desires of our heart and then the sight of our eyes, but that we remember that for all these things, God is going to bring us into judgment. In chapter 12, beginning in verse 9, he tells us a third thing, and that is that life is a school. Life is a school, and we need to learn the lessons of life. Somebody has said that the problem with life being a school and learning the lessons is sometimes we don't realize what lessons we were supposed to have learned until we failed the test. Oh, I was supposed to have learned that one. But he tells us we need to learn. And in verse 9, he talks about himself. He says, in addition to being a wise man, the preacher also taught people knowledge. He pondered and searched out and arranged many proverbs. The preacher sought to find delightful words to write and to write words of truth correctly. His teaching was wise. Solomon, as we know, was the wisest of men. He studied and explored many subjects. He wrote them down, and the conclusions that he drew were often in the form of proverbs. But his words were truth. You see, once Solomon had studied a matter, once he had sought out just the right words, they were what he called delightful words, or as we find over in chapter 10, verse 12, the words of a wise man are gracious. What's he trying to do? He's working to win the attention of his listeners and the readers. But he also mentions that he used them, the words of this man, are as goads. Verse 11. And he says, they are like well-driven nails. They are given by one shepherd. See, they're used to guide us, to move us in the right direction. And we do well to listen, to pay attention. Life is to be lived as a lesson, but we are to learn the lessons. We're to pay attention. Which brings me to the last point. Life is a stewardship. And what he would say to us is this: fear God. Folks, we don't own our lives. You don't own your life. I don't own my life. It's a gift of God. The breath I breathe right now is because God allows me to breathe. And we are stewards of our lives. But one day we will give an account to God for how we have lived our lives. There are some people that go through life spending their life. That's all they do with it, is they spend it. There are some people that waste their lives. And you look at their life at the end and you think, what a waste. Why? They could have been so much. They could have done so much. Why did they waste their life? But then there are a few people There are few people who invest their lives. They look for what they can do with their life and the good that they can do with it. Corrie Ten Boom, maybe you're familiar with that name, especially if you're familiar with World War II. Corrie Ten Boom said that the measure of a life, after all, is not its duration, but its donation. The measure of your life is not how long it lasts, but what you do with it. It's donation to the world around it. And so, if we're to make our lives count, Solomon tells us there are three things that we need to think about. Number one is this: we need to fear God. Chapter 12, verse 13. The conclusion, when all has been heard, fear God. And we'll stop there. You see, Solomon said, if you go back to Proverbs chapter 1, verse 7, he says, the fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge. But the fear of the Lord is an attitude of reverence. It's an attitude of awe that God's people show to Him because they love Him and because they respect His power and because they also respect His greatness. And the person who fears God is a person who's going to pay attention to His Word and going to try to obey that Word. That's what it means to fear God. There was a man by the name of Oswald Chambers. He wrote a book called My Utmost for His Highest. And one of the things he said, I'm not sure it's in that book, but one of the things he said is this: the remarkable thing about fearing God is that when you fear God, you fear nothing else. Whereas if you do not fear God, you fear everything else. If I fear God, I don't worry about what man can do to me, because I'm going to honor God. Let man do what he may. The prophet Isaiah put it this way over in Isaiah chapter 13, verse 8. He said this, he said, it is the Lord of hosts whom you should regard as holy, and He shall be your fear, and He shall be your dread. God is the one that we should fear. So the first thing that Solomon says to us is this: fear God. Then there's the second part, and keep His commandments. God is the one who created us, and God is the one who knows how our lives should be lived. As a matter of fact, He has given us what we might call an instruction manual. And have you ever heard the saying, when all else fails, read the instructions? Maybe a few of you wives have said that to your husbands after they've failed at something two or three times, and then you said, well, here are the instructions, would you like to read them? And that just frustrates you more. But when it comes to your life, you do well to start with the instructions first. Read the instruction manual. And if you'll do that, you'll find that the wise person, first of all, will follow the manual. And the fear of the Lord will result in obedient living, holy living. But if it does not, then it means that there's no fear, no true fear there. Not holy fear. You see, the dedicated believer will want to spend time on a daily basis in Scripture, getting to know the Master, getting to know the Father, better understanding who the Father is and how He wants us to live. As a matter of fact, the last part of this verse, if you're reading tonight from the English Standard Version, it translates it this way: this is the whole duty of man. Our lives begin and end with God. Our whole duty is to fear Him and to keep His commandments. There is nothing more important than that. Which brings me to the last thing that Solomon says in this, and that is that we need to prepare for the final judgment. Or as he puts it here in the very last verse, for God will bring every act to judgment, everything which is hidden, whether good or evil. If you go back to chapter 3 and verse 17 in this book right here in Ecclesiastes, Solomon said there that God will judge both the righteous man and the wicked man. If you come forward to chapter 11 where we just were at and look at verse 9, he says there that the young man should follow the ways, while they should follow the ways of their heart and the sight of their eyes. Solomon then states, but know, as I've already said, that for all these things, God will bring you into judgment. So twice, chapter 3 and here in chapter 11, he said, God is going to judge us. There's a famous passage in the New Testament in which Paul says the same thing. It's over in 2 Corinthians chapter 5, verse 10, because there what Paul does is he reminds the Christians in Corinth that we must all appear before the judgment seat of Christ. And then he tells us why. To be recompensed for the deeds which we have done in the body, this physical body, according to what we have done, whether good or bad. Folks, every single one of us one day are going to stand before Christ in judgment. All of us are. The question is, and it's really a very simple question, are we ready? Are we ready for that day? So I come back to the question that we started with in the beginning, the question Solomon was asking, is life worth living? There are some that live with a very dark attitude toward life that would tell you, as Solomon originally did, no, life is not worth living. But I stand here tonight to tell you that life is worth living. It is worth living if the life which we are living in this flesh, we are living by faith in the Son of God, who, as Paul said, loved us and gave himself for us. Life is worth living if you're living it in a way that honors God. If you're living it in a way that is going to result in your condemnation, it's not worth living, because what is waiting is something you do not want to experience. It is a place that God has prepared for the devil and his angels. But there will be those who have walked this earth since its beginning that will also wind up there, because they are living a life that is not pleasing to God. You see, it's only when we're living it for Christ that we can truly be satisfied in life, no matter what God may permit to come into our lives. It's as the Apostle John wrote over in 1 John chapter 5, verse 12, he who has the Son has life. He who does not have the Son does not have life. So here's a very simple question. Do you have the Son tonight? Is Jesus Christ the one who has covered you with his blood tonight? Have you been buried with him in baptism so that your sins can be washed away? Because if you have the Son, you have life. But if you do not have the Son, I must tell you, you're playing a very dangerous game, because you do not have life. Tonight, if you'd like to change that, if you'd like to know a life that is worth living, a life that has great joy, because Jesus said, I came that they might have life and that they might have it abundantly. If that is the life you choose, but you've not yet rendered obedience to Christ, you've not yet confessed him as Lord and Savior, turning away from your sin, being buried with him in baptism, then why not tonight, right now, as together we stand and sing.